Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. The mass shooting at Washington, D.C.'s Navy Yard last week has reignited the long-standing debate over gun control. There are many who say that nothing is likely to change after the shootings, a point addressed by President Obama at Sunday's memorial service for the victims.
Alongside the anguish of these American families, alongside the accumulated outrage so many of us feel, sometimes I fear there's a creeping resignation that these tragedies are just somehow the way it is, that this is somehow the new normal.
Is this the new normal? This hour we're talking about gun laws, especially as they relate to people with mental illness. But we begin with a look at the politics of gun control and why those who support it feel like they're spinning their wheels. John Gramlich covers legal affairs for CQ Roll Call, that is Congressional Quarterly. His work has also been published in the Washington Post, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Houston Chronicle, and other publications. John, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
So, as you well know, every time an event like this happens, it renews the debate over gun control, and it also, more recently, brings up the conventional wisdom that nothing is likely to change. Do you agree with that? And if so, why is nothing likely to happen?
Well, I do agree with it. I had the opportunity to cover this last gun control debate after the Newtown shooting in Connecticut, and that lasted about 6 months. And it was all pretty much on the Senate side of the Capitol, and it ended in failure of pretty much all of the president and the Democrats' policy proposals. And so this time it's very clear that there's not that kind of momentum behind those same changes, because even the biggest supporters of gun control in the Senate, people like Dianne Feinstein of California and the two members of the Connecticut delegation who were, you know, taking the lead after Newtown, they are pretty much saying that they don't see much different and that they don't have the votes and that they're really just frustrated. So they're striking a different tone, almost one of resignation this time.
And John, not too long ago, two state legislators in Colorado were recalled because of their support of gun control. Does that signal a shift in public opinion as well?
It's hard to gauge how much that Colorado recall signals anything beyond, you know, the districts of those two state legislators in Colorado. It was certainly national news because it was sort of a proxy fight for between the NRA and Mayor Bloomberg's gun control group, and it did catch the attention of people on Capitol Hill too. I mean, there were members of Congress talking about it last week after the Navy Yard shooting, but it's hard to say definitively that is, you know, where public opinion nationally is at. Colorado took a number of steps this year on guns that many other states did not take or could not take, and so there was a policy that people were reacting to. And then there's also sort of an undercurrent of, in Colorado, maybe it was a reaction to other policies also, because the Democratic legislature there made changes that were, you know, that they've been wanting for a long time, such as civil unions for gay couples. And so it's hard to pinpoint exactly how much it has to do with guns.
Gun control advocates have also been accused, as you know, of not protecting the legislators who might be willing to help them. Essentially, the accusation is, hey, you can't guarantee me that I'm going to be reelected if I support you. Is that the case, and that this is an area where perhaps gun control advocates have made a misstep?
Well, I can tell you that there's a lot of members of the Congress who do not really want to see this debate come back and have them have a vote before the elections next year. I mean, that's very clear. It was a very difficult vote for a lot of members of the Senate, particularly these vulnerable Democrats in conservative states, people like Mark Begich in Alaska and Mark Pryor in Arkansas. So those people are certainly not eager to have another vote even closer to Election Day. So I think to some extent the leadership in the Senate is looking out for their members. They're, you know, they'd rather not do this all over again and keep the Senate than do it all over again, possibly still fail and lose the Senate. Hmm.
Is it possible, John, that after another election cycle that we might see gun control advocates sort of taking a page out of the playbook of same-sex marriage advocates who have promised legislators pretty successfully that, hey, we'll take care of you if you, you know, vote for this. We will make sure that we look out for you.
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to it. I mean, I think that that is the hope. These gun control groups that really came out of the woodwork in a new way after Newtown, people like Mayors Against Illegal Guns, that's Mayor Bloomberg's group, and the group founded after Newtown by Gabby Giffords, the former representative from Arizona, they decided to put new money and new momentum behind these kind of challenges. But from Colorado, you see that they're just not there yet in influencing the public. It's not clear that they have sort of the infrastructure, the long-standing infrastructure that the pro-gun crowd like the NRA has, because the spending in Colorado was dramatically on the side of the legislators, not their opponents. I think it was something like 5-1 in favor of the legislators, and both of them still lost their seats.
So what has been the deal breaker consistently, at least in Washington, when it comes to gun legislation? Is it universal background checks? What is it that seems to be the stumbling block?
Well, from where I sit, it seems like the biggest thing that comes up and that you know gets proposals that might ordinarily have a chance of passing, gets them in trouble, is this sort of slippery slope argument. You see that a lot where proposals that have bipartisan support, so say the background checks proposal, for example. This was, by all accounts, a fairly modest expansion of the current background check system. This is the one that failed in April. It would have required background checks for online gun sales, which in some cases are now exempt, and also for gun sales made by private sellers at gun shows. And so this was not at all the universal background checks argument that the president wanted. It was a very modest step, and it was bipartisan. But as that process sort of continued, you had bipartisan support at the beginning. You had a lot of conservative Republicans open to the idea because one of their own, Pat Toomey from your state, was supporting it. But this pretty much it fell by the wayside because of the slippery slope argument, where people were saying this is just the first step to a universal gun background check system, and that background check system is then the first step to a universal registry of gun owners, and then that in turn is the first step to taking people's guns away from them. So there's a lot of fear and mistrust of the government when it comes to the issue of guns.
And it seems that in light of that states are taking matters into their own hands, in the sense that we see different states approaching this issue in different ways now.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I've sort of thought about what will happen maybe 10 years from now or 15 years from now. Will there be research that shows any significant differences in states like Maryland and Colorado that have now, and New York, that now have really some very, very strong gun laws, and states that do not, like, Kentucky or maybe Virginia, some of these other states that have gone in the opposite direction. And so you really have Democratic-leaning states going in one direction and Republican states going in a completely different direction. And so it'll be interesting to see a long time from now whether the policies of one state can be measurably, different from the policies of another.
Is there any evidence at this point, or is it too early to tell how successful some of these states are? I'm thinking of New York in particular with its gun control laws. Is there enough evidence yet to know one way or the other how successful?
I don't think so. No, that law has been on the books for, I believe, less than a year, possibly less than even 6 months. So it's very new. I do know that there's political evidence, of course. I mean, the Colorado recall is one example. In New York, you have a lot of law enforcement people who are completely unhappy about the law. So the political backlash has been there and probably will continue to be there, but it's too early to say what the actual, on-the-ground effects will be. And, of course, gun control proponents, the people who want to see federal action, will say and continue to say that individual state action is great, but without a federal law, any person who wants to commit a crime with a gun can just go to a weak gun law state, buy the gun there, and come back and commit the crime in a Maryland or a Colorado. So they're saying that, it's very hard to measure even state laws.
Increasingly, the question of mental illness is coming into play in this debate, John, as you no doubt know. What are you seeing and what are you hearing as it relates to legislation that would involve, say, identifying people who may be prone to acts of violence, the whole idea that's been tossed around about registries, background lists of people who may fall into certain categories that may be deemed dangerous. What's going on around that at this point?
I would say that there's broad bipartisan consensus on the general point of the government should keep guns out of the hands of people who have mental illness. I mean, you hear conservative Republicans saying that, you hear liberal Democrats saying that. That was true after Newtown, and it's true now. And you do have a number of different proposals that are out there that have had broad bipartisan support. But I think that there's a little disconnect between that talk and those proposals and very specific policy actions. So, for example, everyone says let's do more to shore up the mental health system. But what exactly does that mean? And agreeing on that second part is a little bit more difficult. You have a number of different proposals out there, most of which revolve around just pouring money into the system that exists currently. Of course, money is hard to come by these days in Washington. You have another proposal by someone like Senator Al Franken, who wants to just expand mental health treatment in the criminal justice system to make sure that, you know, people there don't just cycle through prison and then commit more violence, that they actually get help and change those violent tendencies. So I think getting from the general talking point to the specific policy is the challenge on mental health.
Is anyone talking about increasing access to health care in the general population at this point?
Yeah. Representative Tim Murphy, from Pennsylvania, he's the chairman of a subcommittee in the House. He's a Republican, and he took to the House floor last week, and he talked about just the general shortage of mental health psychiatric beds in this country. He said in 1955 there was 500,000 beds for people who needed help, and today that number has shrunk below 100,000. And so he is talking about just generally doing more, putting more infrastructure in there to help people with mental illness. But again, that just raises the question of would money, would more beds actually prevent someone like this guy Aaron Alexis, who committed the Navy Yard shooting, from doing something like that? That's always a hard connection to make.
Well, and that's exactly what we'll be talking about a little bit later in the program. We have a behavioral scientist from Duke with us who will help us address these issues of mental illness and how it relates to gun violence and what some of the research is telling us about that. So we encourage everyone to stick around for that. John, as you watch all of this play out, and I know you said that with an election year coming up, chances are we won't see a whole lot happen, at least not anytime soon. But, you know, looking out into the next several years, how do you view this? What do you think we're going to be seeing happening politically as it relates to gun control? Is there hope that there might be some sort of law that can gain traction and get support and be put in place at the national level? Or what are your thoughts about what we might be looking at?
Well, I don't think that all action is necessarily written off for the remainder of this Congress. I think it probably is when it comes to guns themselves. But like I mentioned, there is some talk around mental health, and so I do think it's at least a possibility that you will see some legislation on that move through the current Congress because it does have bipartisan support. You also have different sort of reactions to the Navy Yard shooting that could happen, such as improving base security, you know, metal detectors, and making sure that that there is, you know, this stuff in place to make sure that people can't get on base and do this kind of thing. You also hear a lot of talk about screening government contractors more closely and more carefully. Aaron Alexis was a government contractor, of course, so was Edward Snowden, who has caused a lot of headaches for the Obama administration.
John, I'm going to stop you right there because I've got to take a break, but I want to thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times and helping us understand the politics around gun control. Radio Times will be right back.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
This Week in This American Life, it is a very popular drug. Every week, one out of six Americans take some. I'm talking about acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol. And it also kills more people than any other over-the-counter painkiller. Over 150 Americans die each year, on average, from accidentally taking too much, according to the federal government. It takes a lot less to endanger you than you may know. This week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, manufacturing in China is on the rise. Could that mean an end to the slowdown of the world's second largest economy? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We've been talking about the politics of gun control in light of the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard shooting last week. We were talking with John Gramlich, who is legal affairs correspondent for the Congressional Quarterly Roll Call, and we thank John again for being with us in the earlier part of the program. We want to shift gears a little bit at this point, and we want to talk about the mental health issue and how that folds into this discussion of gun control and gun violence. And as details about the shooter at the Navy Yard begin to emerge, so did a portrait of a young man who was struggling with mental illness. Leading up to the shootings, Aaron Alexis had complained of hearing voices and believed that someone was, as he put it, shooting vibrations into his body to keep him awake. There had been prior run-ins with the law over gun-related violations and in several places around the country, and the debate over gun control moved front and center again after last week, but increasingly that debate has to do with mental illness. What level of mental illness is sufficient to deprive a person of their right to possess a gun? How would such people be identified? Those are some of the questions that are really just the tip of the iceberg in the debate over guns, access, and mental illness. And so joining us to help us sort out the issues is Jeffrey Swanson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. Dr. Swanson is the author or co-author of more than 180 publications, including Violence and Severe Mental Illness and the Impact of Involuntary Outpatient Commitment Law. He is currently principal investigator of a multi-site study on firearms laws, mental illness, and prevention of violence. Dr. Swanson, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Welcome to. Glad to be here.
Well, so identifying people who are mentally ill enough to present potential harm to themselves or others, and then denying them access to firearms might seem to make sense on its face, but much easier said than done, as you well know. What are some of the challenges associated with trying to do that?
Well, you know, here we are again, absorbing the news of another mass casualty shooting by another troubled young man. And, you know, it's tragic, and it always appears after the fact, you know, through our retrospectoscope, that this should have been predicted and prevented. But it's difficult to do that because, you know, violent behavior is relatively rare. It doesn't seem like that because it gets lots of attention. But it's rare, and it's complicated because it's caused by many different things. Mental illness is one factor, but the vast majority of people with mental illness don't commit violent acts. So, you know, with a mass shooter after the fact, you know, it looks like here's someone who is young and male and socially isolated and perhaps had some delusional beliefs and might have had problems, including mental illness. But that matches the description of lots of people who will not do this. So if we have a strategy that really depends on being able to pick out that needle in the haystack, that's going to be very difficult, and I think we need to have some other strategies.
I want to invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. We are talking about the mental health piece of the gun debate. The number to join us is 888-477-9499. We are talking with Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. And you mentioned just a moment ago that the vast majority of people with mental illness do not commit violent crimes. What does the research show? Because I think there is a perception, in our country at least, that there is a definitive link there.
Right. Well, there's a link in terms of the relative risk. So people who have disorders such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and major depression are about three times more likely to commit some act of either minor or serious violent behavior compared to people without mental illness. But that's about 7% in terms of the absolute risk. So, you know, it's whether you look at it from a comparative point of view versus, you know, how many people, what's the proportion of people who will commit a violent act. And so you can make two points with the same data. You can say most people with mental illness are not violent, And in fact, the idea in the public mind, you know, I mean, if you learned everything you knew about schizophrenia by watching television in this country, you'd think that every person with schizophrenia was a homicidal maniac. And that's really unfortunate because that idea, and 60% of the adults in this country, according to opinion polls, believe that people with schizophrenia are very likely to be dangerous. The actual prevalence is about 7%, and if you include substance abuse in there, about 12%. So there's a big disconnect. And that's just any violence. If you think about, you know, committing a homicide against a stranger, that's maybe 1 in 70,000 people with schizophrenia. So, you know, that is really, you know, it's rare, and it's harmful to other people with mental illness because of the stigma, the discrimination, the social rejection that goes along with this assumption. So how to balance that concern with public safety and risk with thinking about the broader problem of mental illness. Mental illness and violence are two separate public health problems that intersect, you know, at the margins.
And yet, Jeffrey, when we look at these mass shootings, so often we find that the shooter, in fact, did have some sort of mental issue, and there will be those who will listen to this and say, well, isn't one too many?
Well, certainly that's the case. And we need to think about how to prevent that from happening. You know, and one way to think about this is if we have a strategy that's going to say, well, let's look at people who are in treatment for mental illness and pick out those who match the characteristics of a mass shooter and identify that person. Well, a number of the mass shooters didn't even have any record, weren't even in the system. If you look at the prevalence of mental illness by where you study it, one of the highest groups at risk are first episode psychosis patients who are in a period before they've ever presented for care. And so, you know, that is a real challenge because they're out there and it's not as if you can kind of identify them. So I think, you know, in the end, and we can talk about this, it's a complex problem and you need to think about the upstream causes of violent behavior, how to limit access to firearms or lethal means for people. And those things together, and then also certainly the firearms issue, how to you know, make guns less lethal and safer and, you know, more less available to people who might harm others or themselves.
Yeah. You were listening in when we talked earlier about a number of states establishing their own laws as it relates to guns, mental health, an assortment of issues. And I'm thinking about New York in particular. But you have written that these laws are both sensible and overreaching at the same time. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, the New York example is something that, you know, I call sort of crisis-driven law or crisis-driven policy. And, you know, there's this rush to want to do something in the aftermath of a mass shooting. And so, you know, this law, the New York Safe Act, the Secure Ammunition and Firearms Enforcement Act, it did some things that sort of gun control advocates agree with, you know, background checks and increasing penalties for people, beefing up enforcement for people who use illegal guns and banning assault weapons and so on. But then it reached into mental health territory and it said, why don't we require mental health professionals to report persons at risk of harming themselves or others to the police and match them to the gun registry? And while we're at it, why don't we expand the state's involuntary outpatient commitment law, make the initial period of commitment a year instead of 6 months, and actually think about people coming out of the criminal justice system and see if they meet the criteria for that. Well, at that point, you get, you know, some strange bedfellows, because on the one hand, you have people like the Sheriff's Association and the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, the NRA, saying, well, you know, we don't like this. They think it reaches too far and, you know, violates the Second Amendment to the Constitution or that kind of argument. On the other hand, you have the mental health stakeholders, the psychiatrists and the social workers and the nurses and the mental health advocates, and they don't like it either because they say this sort of criminalizes mental illness and is going to have a chilling effect on help seeking. It's going to keep people who need help from seeking help, and it will inhibit people's disclosures in therapy. If they think, wow, I'm going to be reported to the police, I'm not going to tell my doctor, you know, what I really think. You know, so you get some strange kinds of people. You have supporters of mental health in the gun rights community who, you know, would rather talk about that, untreated mental illness as the problem rather than unregulated guns.
And what is a clinician to do in a situation like that where there is a responsibility to report someone who could be harmful and, God forbid, someone does go out and do something where people are harmed, and weighing that against the issue of patient confidentiality, against, as you pointed out, the stigma that can be attached and people being afraid to even disclose what they're thinking or some of their concerns because they don't want to be, you know, thrown into a database or stigmatized in some other way.
Well, this was not an argument that, you know, people in the civil commitment system who've already been found to pose a danger to themselves or others or meet those requirements, you know, shouldn't be denied firearms. This was considered to be too broad because it covered, you know, people in private psychotherapeutic settings, people out there, you know, students who might go see a counselor. And the fact is that mental health professionals already have a number of tools at their disposal, at their discretion. They could decide to see the patient more frequently. They could change the patient's medication. They could many times encourage voluntary hospitalization without worrying about, you know, violating that fundamental confidentiality of the doctor-patient relationship. You know, so it's a matter of balancing the potential downside with, you know, with trying to identify people at risk. And I think one of the principles, really, about thinking about reforms in this area is to try to limit access to guns for people when they are at risk and when they're dangerous, irrespective of their mental health diagnosis or anything like that. And, you know, not just having a policy to keep someone from buying a new gun from a licensed dealer, but to deal with the guns they may already have. And that's another
issue,
certainly.
Yeah. You have written about research that suggests that clinicians are not necessarily all that good at predicting who might be dangerous or who might not be someone who should have access to a gun anyway.
Yeah, the research, I mean, there's been a number of studies of this, and it was a classic one done at the University of Pittsburgh in the 1990s where patients were you know, studied prospectively. They came to the emergency room and you know, doctors identified some as being at risk of violence and others not, and then they were followed for a year. And it turned out that doctors just weren't very good using clinical judgment at predicting who was going to be violent. Now, there's a vast amount of research looking across probably 75 studies of the validity of these predictions. And, you know, as I've said, clinicians are pretty good using these structured risk assessment instruments at ruling out people who are not going to be violent. When they say someone will be violent, the problem is the risk factors for violence are shared by lots of people who will not be. So those risk assessments are there's lots of false positives, which means that the criteria for a gun disqualification tends to be both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. Mm-hmm. It scoops up a lot of people who are probably have zero risk of violence, and it fails to identify some who are.
And yet there have to be key markers that mental health professionals are looking for as they're treating people, as they're talking with patients, that could be red flags, correct?
Well, certainly, and history of violence is probably a big one. You know, if someone had a history of multiple involuntary commitments and associated with you know, violent or aggressive behavior or a criminal background. Certainly, you know, those things. Substance abuse is another big factor co-occurring with mental illness. It can disinhibit aggressive behavior and impulsivity. It can make worrisome psychiatric symptoms like paranoia worse and excessive threat perception worse. Also, if you think about people who use illicit drugs, what kinds of associations do they have in procuring drugs? And so just the sort of criminogenic or environment that people are involved in is also a part of that. So substance abuse co-occurring with mental illness is a big factor. Mm-hmm. You know, but again, you know, in the data that we've looked at, the highest risk profile, a young male, socially disadvantaged, with mental illness and substance abuse, and a history of arrest and hospitalization, the probability is about 65% in a year that they would do some minor act of violence. But that's, you know, 35% who will not. And that's just any kind of violence, even hitting someone with your fist. You know, a mass shooting, getting a gun and going killing a bunch of people, that is, again, a needle in a haystack.
What about someone like an Aaron Alexis, the Navy Yard shooter, who did, as we pointed out, express that he was hearing voices, that people were trying to shoot vibrations through his body, that sort of thing? Is that enough to raise a red flag? What about someone like him who maybe doesn't have all the criteria that you just mentioned, but does communicate some disturbing things?
Well, you know, I don't know about him in particular. I would say that, you know, I'm impressed again with the research on hindsight bias, that if you randomly assign psychiatrists to read records and you tell one group, these are patients who committed a homicide or a suicide. Now, your task is to comb through and look for red flags. And then you assign another group the same records, and you don't tell them that a suicide or homicide occurred. The group that thinks that this is a story that had a very bad end are far more likely, statistically more likely, to find the red flags. These are things that should have been identified, and this is the standard of care. And, you know, the other side, they don't see anything out of the ordinary because they see lots and lots of patients like this. So, you know, thinking about it after the fact, there's some, you know, as I say, through the retrospectoscope is a little bit flawed. But the bigger issue really is lack of access to treatment. You know, we have probably 4 to 5% of the adults in this country have serious mental illness. And the majority of them are not receiving any treatment at all. Mm. And there are a lot of reasons for that.
Well, and let's talk about that, because that certainly is an issue. And we talked a little bit about that early on with John Gramlich. But just getting access at all to mental health care for people who may need it most can be very difficult. Why is that?
Well, you know, in the aftermath of deinstitutionalization, it is correct that you know, we've gone from a period of time in the middle of the 20th century where 500,000 people were in these large state mental health facilities, you know, the sort of the asylum type of institution, and now a small fraction of that. And the premise there of moving people to the community was that we would have a funded, well-funded community mental health center that would kind of wrap around people. And that really failed to materialize. It sort of got a good start, and then it was, you know, ran out of steam in the 1980s. So you have people with real needs, real barriers to care. I mean, sometimes they're systemic barriers. Sometimes it has to do with the individual who doesn't know that they need mental illness and is reluctant to get treatment. Lots of people don't have health insurance, or they don't have coverage for mental health treatment. When they need inpatient treatment, maybe beds are not available. So, you know, we have a system that is overburdened, underfunded, too often ineffective, and we need better treatments, more tolerable treatments that people can adhere to, you know, but better ways of reaching out to people and delivering them. And we have good evidence-based treatments that have, like, assertive community treatment to provide outreach to people and wrap around the services that they need. But those kinds of slots are really unavailable.
We are talking with Dr. Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. We're talking about mental health and the role that it is playing now in the debate about guns. We'll talk about that and much more, plus your calls, when Radio Times comes right back.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, as the groundwork is being laid for negotiations with Iran about its nuclear program, we talk about a more covert Iranian story, Iran's Quds Force, which is like a combination of the CIA and the Special Forces. Its leader is directing Assad's war in Syria. We talk with Dexter Filkins about his article, The Shadow Commander, in the current New Yorker. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Obama at the UN. Destination Iran.
The roadblocks may prove to be too great, but I firmly believe the diplomatic path must be tested.
The president's diplomatic bulldozer has a name.
Given President Rouhani's stated commitment to reach an agreement, I am directing John Kerry to pursue this effort.
The Kerry Initiative and Iran's nuclear program next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. And of course, in the wake of the shooting at the Washington, D.C. Navy Yard last week, the debate over gun control has been revived yet again, although this time, as many are pointing out, with a sense of resignation that nothing may be likely to change, at least not in the near future. We've also been talking about the mental health component of this debate, which is getting increasing attention. And we've been talking with Jeffrey Swanson. He is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. He also is the principal investigator of a multi-site study on firearms laws, mental illness, and prevention of violence. We welcome your calls, your questions for Dr. Swanson. The number is 888-477-9499. And Jeffrey, I wanted to talk about how suicide fits into all of this, because you have said that any discussion of mental health and guns has to have as a major part of that discussion suicide.
Yeah, that's really important. Too often the problem is defined, the connection between violence and mental illness is defined only in terms of violent acts against other people. And if that's your view, well, you know, mental health is not a very strong factor. If we cured schizophrenia and depression and bipolar disorder, probably violence against others would go down by about 4 or 5%. But the fact is that 60%, according to the CDC, of firearms-related death is suicide, and so people dying by their own hand.
And that's 60%.
Yeah, that's 60% of the firearms mortality of gun deaths are suicides. So if you think about it that way, then mental health and mental illness and mental health problems are a much bigger issue. They have a much stronger component in it, and so mental health interventions have a much greater potential to prevent suicide. And access to lethal means is a huge issue, too, because, you know, the fact is that if someone shoots you, you have about 80% chance of surviving. If you shoot yourself in an act of in a suicide attempt, you're almost certainly to die because people point at the brain at close range and there's almost never someone there to call 911. And so that's really sad because, the illnesses that people have that increase risk for suicide are treatable. And when someone survives a suicide attempt, they're unlikely to go on and die from suicide. So, and that's a big part of the cost of the gun violence problem, if you think about it, is just those lost years and the diminished quality of life for the families who were left behind. But that makes it more complicated too, because the risk factors for suicide and for acts of violence against others, while they overlap, they're different, and you need different strategies.
What are some of those risk factors, and how is it a slightly different conversation when we're talking about suicide as opposed to a mass shooting or going out, shooting someone else?
Well, the biggest mental health issue underlying suicide is depression, which often strikes young people. And, you could think about a vulnerable population being college students. That's the age at which young people, go away from home. They're cut off from some of their support systems. They're facing a stressful environment. And, maybe they don't want to talk about the feelings that they have. But somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,300 to 1,500 college students every year commit suicide. So, that's a population where one could think about intervening. And the state of Virginia actually did that in the aftermath of the Virginia Tech shooting and passed some legislation to try to prevent suicide as well as other kinds of violent acts in college students. So, again, suicide is complicated because it's not just one factor, and largely the vast majority of people with depression don't do that. Many people think about suicide and might attempt it, but again, if you attempt it with a gun, that's very bad.
Yeah. And because depression seems to be an increasingly common diagnosis, is it really becoming more common? Is it just being diagnosed more frequently or drugs being prescribed more frequently? I guess the ultimate question is there an increasing population of people who really are struggling with depression and may find themselves at risk for these things?
Well, that's a hard question to answer, because it's certainly true that consciousness of depression, just the language for talking about depression, has changed over the generations. You know, when my grandfather was young, he had problems, and nobody talked about depression. But he was unable to work for a year. In late life, he was treated for depression, and in retrospect, that's what he thought that he had. But nowadays, you know, every magazine that you read and, you know, online, do you have depression? So I think that's part of it. But also, there are lots of risk factors for depression. Part of it is biological, and part of it has to do with, stress in the environment and just the adaptive effort that it takes. So I think it's a combination of those things. Mm-hmm. But we do have effective treatment for depression. And, getting access to it is something to strive for.
That's the key. Let's go to the phones to Camden, New Jersey, and we'll welcome Clinton to our conversation. Hi, Clinton. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. So the question I have is regarding the FDA's black box warning that taking a lot of the psychiatric drugs, in particular, SSRIs, has a documented side effect of causing suicidal behavior, as well as some of them actually have homicidal thoughts associated with actually taking the drug that's supposed to treat this. And so how do you reconcile the increased utilization of these drugs with the higher gun violence, since the FDA has found clinical evidence to prove that they are associated?
All right. Thank you for your call, Clinton.
Well, I think those are a couple of different issues that may collide, but the issue concerning potential side effects, adverse side effects, including perhaps suicidal behavior associated with taking antidepressant medications, is a concern, but it's an extremely rare side effect. It's something that we need to point to, but you need to think about that and balance it with the benefit that millions and millions of people have from effective treatment. So, it would be great if people could take the medicine that they need, find the one that works for them, but also have access to a mental health professional who could carefully monitor their response to the medication and be alerted if there are any kinds of side effects. I think that the connection of that to the gun violence one is perhaps a little strained, because again, the vast majority of violent acts are not caused by mental illness. And when violent behavior does occur, mental illness is almost never, the master explanation for it. There are other things that come together and interact with it, mm-hmm. In terms of other risk factors and precipitating conditions, in the environment.
I want to talk a little bit about veterans and this whole issue of mental health and firearms. I know that there are certain veterans who have fiduciaries who they have been deemed not able to, say, handle their financial situations, and so they've got fiduciaries to help with that. And I know that there is legislation pending that would restore the right to the use of firearms to some of these veterans. What do you think about that, and where is that going?
Well, the policy that the VA has, I think, needs to be understood in the context of the federal law, which basically says that people who have had a history of some kind of mental health adjudication, either involuntary commitment or they've been found in some legal proceeding or by a judicial authority to be unable to manage their own affairs or to be dangerous or in a criminal matter, incompetent to stand trial. The VA takes that and uses this designation of a fiduciary, which is like a representative payee for someone who can't manage their own benefit, according to this judgment. And that is kind of seen as an indicator of incapacity. And it applies to probably 120,000 veterans or so. I think that there's certainly an argument to be made from a public safety point of view that veterans who have disorders such as post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse and a number of mental health-related problems, should not have access to firearms. On the other hand, there's a constitutional right at stake, and the question of whether or not the removal of that right has been associated with due process in a legal sense, is also a matter for some discussion. I think that we need to look very carefully at legislation that would simply automatically restore gun rights to veterans, as well as some proposals that say that the prohibition of firearms should only last as long as a civil commitment order, which would mean that someone could walk right out of the hospital after a period of hospitalization and go straight to a gun store.
Well, and the other concern, and you pointed this out earlier, for veterans is not just harming someone else, but the suicide rate as it is among veterans.
Yes, it's very high. It's an epidemic, and veterans, compared to other sectors of the population, are more likely to have firearms and to know how to use them, and across the generations are more likely to commit suicide than their non-veteran counterparts, including older veterans. I mean, we tend to think of it in terms of the younger cohort of post deployment in recent wars, but veterans who are in late life are also at increased risk of suicide, and it's almost always with a firearm.
And is it true that the rate of suicide among veterans is actually higher than the number of war casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I believe that's true.
Yeah, staggering. You mentioned someone coming out of the hospital and then having their rights restored. What does it take at this point for someone to be involuntarily committed? If there is concern among healthcare professionals, family, et cetera, how difficult is that to do?
Well, it's difficult. And, in the 1970s, after deinstitutionalization, civil commitment statutes and laws all over the United States were reformed to make sure that that people whose right to refuse treatment and to be free and not confined in a mental hospital, that those rights were upheld. So basically it broke down to the criteria of having a mental disorder and also posing some danger to others or self, or being incompetent. And the two legal doctrines there, one would be the police powers of the state to try to protect people, and the other would be what's called parens patriae, or the state acting as a parent to take care of someone who can't take care of themselves. Now, when you go to what states do, though, the way in which those principles are implemented are highly variable, so that there are some states that do very, very little involuntary commitment, and they have ways of, for example, someone might be brought in on an emergency commitment, but then they sort of convert to a voluntary hospitalization. In other states, civil commitment is used extensively, and it's used in the context of transporting people, using law enforcement to transport someone from where they might present for care in an emergency department to a regional state psychiatric hospital. So if that varies from, maybe 7% in one state to, 80 or 90% in another state, it's hard to say that that's rational. And that has a direct connection to the issue of disqualifying people from firearms, because the law is embedded in civil commitment policy.
So as you have done all of this research and you're continuing to look at these issues, what does your research tell you about what really needs to happen? Because that, at the end of the day, is the question. How do we work this issue out so that those who are advocates for, firearm possession feel comfortable, so that those who are advocates for gun control feel comfortable? What does your research tell you that we need at this point?
Well, it's not just one thing. I mean, I think that you know, background checks and extending background checks is one part of the solution. But the way it's implemented right now, it won't work. If, you know, 40% of the firearms transfers take place outside the background check system, that's not going to work. We need a little bit better criteria. It needs to be focused more on risk. And there are models, state statutes, such as Indiana has, where clinicians can engage law enforcement to remove guns from people at the time when they are at risk, pending a judge weighing in on the evidence of their threat to public safety. So there is the whole part of trying to do a better job, a more comprehensive job, of keeping firearms away from people at the time when they pose a risk of harming themselves or others. That's one part of it. But our research shows that that would probably only have a marginal effect. Mm-hmm. In the state of Connecticut, for example, only 7% of the people with serious mental illness in the public system are disqualified from firearms on the basis of a mental health history. So, you know, the other part of it is thinking about going upstream and doing what I call preventing the unpredicted. And, you know, if we had a mental health system that was less fragmented, and there are tools to use, I think involuntary commitment in the outpatient setting, involuntary outpatient commitment, if it's targeted to the right people and the services that are mandated are actually provided, intensive community services, that can be a good tool. But, you know, we are not going to have a big headline that says improved mental health care prevented mass shooting today. Mm-hmm. But we might prevent violent behavior, you know, if we did all the things that we already know how to do. But that requires, you know, getting some consensus and converting the public attention to the currency of political will.
Yeah. Well, and there are lots of things there that that we could talk about. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but we are talking with Dr. Jeffrey Swanson. He is professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. He is studying and has been studying these issues for many years. Dr. Swanson, thank you for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.